Hello again, and welcome back to The Deep End of Public Education. My name is Kristen Grubbs, and I am thankful for each and every one of you who've chosen to continue listening. This episode is part three in a series of episodes in which I analyze Belonging Through a Culture of Dignity by Floyd Cobb and John Cranapple, a book which is currently being used for professional development training in my local school district. In the last couple episodes, we discussed the first several chapters of the book as it laid some groundwork for what Cobb and Cranapple see as the cause for inequity in educational institutions. We also discussed the definitions of belonging, access, oppression, what it means to affirm, and how the authors altered the definition of dignity. Now let's dive back in and continue our swim in the deep end of public education. After discussing what Cobb and Cranapple see as the failures of American education and how equity efforts have gone wrong over the years, the authors submit that, since the concept of equal human worth is the concept of dignity, we could say that the solution to equity in education has been there the whole time. It has been hidden in plain sight. However, once we see it, we also have to recognize our unintentional complicity in the systemic violation of dignity. But by owning the harm that our system of indignity has inflicted and resolving to address the equity problem at its core, we can escape the cycle of dysfunction. The cycle of dysfunction is something I mentioned in the first of this belonging series. It is the cycle they say most school districts fall into when trying to address inequities in education, a cycle for which I believe their assessment is quite accurate. However, what their book leaves out is how their very own practices and beliefs fit perfectly into that cycle of dysfunction. They may claim that addressing the equity problem at the core will break us free from that cycle of dysfunction, but as you learn more through this podcast series, or even through your own dissection of their book, their practices are just as much a cause of the dysfunction as the issues they propose to be the underlying cause. Their proposed solution to inequity is building relationships, and I cannot disagree with that. However, it is in their implementation of this idea that they lose my agreement. In Chapter 6, they describe the concept of othering. They say it's a term for an ancient instinct, that of tribalism, the us versus them mentality, our innate hostility toward the unfamiliar, and the instinct to perceive and push back against those who are different than us. Diving further into this concept of othering, the book continues, saying, the term represents a concept that encompasses systems such as racism, Islamophobia, heterosexism, and so on. These othering processes systemically violate dignity on the basis of group-based identities or membership. They assign unequal value to people and groups based on specific dimensions of difference. For example, Blackness in the United States has historically been stigmatized, socially devalued, with the negative stereotypes and beliefs attached to the identity. We could go on and on naming socially devalued identities in our culture and history, for there are many, and when an individual has numerous stigmatized identities, like Black, female, lesbian, the effects of the devalued worth compound for that individual. Conversely, society has granted overvalued worth to individuals possessing whiteness, maleness, and other identities, such as heterosexual and Christian, that operated as the unstated norm. This overvaluation is a distortion of dignity. It's a violation because it's false dignity, an inflated sense of value based on one's group membership in comparison to, quote, lower groups. Before I go any further into this book, I'd like to tread with you here for a moment and share with you a little background on a concept that's hidden in this excerpt. This concept could almost be viewed like a point system. They're saying stereotypes of certain layers of identity can have a positive or negative effect on a person's sense of value. There are multiple failures in this way of thinking. Before I explain those, I thought I'd share with you a similar concept. A professor at Columbia Law School named Kimberly Crenshaw is credited for naming the now well-known term critical race theory. She is also known for coining the term intersectionality. There's not enough time in this episode to discuss in depth what intersectionality is, its origin, or what effect it's having on society and law. But I'll share with you a bit from the Center for Intersectional Justice, an organization based out of Berlin. On their website, they state, "The concept of intersectionality describes the ways in which systems of inequality based on gender, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender identity, disability, class, and other forms of discrimination intersect to create unique dynamics and effects. For example, when a Muslim woman wearing a hijab is being discriminated, it would be impossible to dissociate her female from her Muslim identity and to isolate the dimensions causing her discrimination. All forms of inequality are mutually reinforcing and must therefore be analyzed and addressed simultaneously to prevent one form of inequality from reinforcing the other. For example, tackling the gender pay gap alone, without including other dimensions such as race, socioeconomic status, and immigration status, will likely reinforce inequalities among women." It's basically saying that all of those hats we wear, like age, race, sex, married status, parent status, job, faith, socioeconomic status, etc., cannot be separated. Intersectionality says that all of the layers of our identity are interwoven and inseparable. The concept Cobb and Crownapple are proposing in their book Belonging Through a Culture of Dignity is that we all have layers of our identity, and each of those layers, depending on what they are, can have a positive or negative effect on how we are received by society. Ironically, they use Black, female, and lesbian as layers of identity that can take points away, so to speak, from a person's perceived value, whereas white, male, heterosexual, and Christian can falsely inflate one's perceived value. Why is it not the other way around? Couldn't someone in today's world flaunt their Black, female, lesbian identity as though they have more value than others? In today's society, isn't it rather common for white, male, heterosexual Christians to be demeaned and devalued? Why do Cobb and Crownapple present these aspects of identity in such a biased way? Another concern I have with the idea of false dignity is that it implies that a person who gives themselves high value could be accused of having false dignity. In other words, just because someone has certain attributes, like white, male, heterosexual, and Christian, that doesn't mean they automatically have an inflated sense of value. Could it possibly be that those who don't share the same layers of identity could assume that this white, straight Christian man thinks too highly of himself? Perhaps the one judging him as having false dignity is the one who is assuming an inflated sense of self. Is that not stereotyping? I believe there is a difference between ego and what Cobb and Crownapple call false dignity. A person can believe they're better than another person without inflating their own value. If we look at this idea using percentages, it'd be like saying each of us is 100% worthy. Someone with an ego might believe they're 100% worthy, but believe someone else isn't as worthy. But by believing they themselves are worthy, that doesn't falsely inflate their sense of worth. They cannot have a level of worthiness higher than 100%. That simply does not exist. Similarly, just because someone's ego says another person is less valuable, that still doesn't change the fact that the other person is also 100% worthy. That's the thing about dignity. It is not granted, nor is it taken. Therefore, it cannot be affected by someone or something else. We are all 100% worthy and valuable, no matter what others say or do. A person treating others as though they are less worthy doesn't falsely increase their value above 100%, nor does it decrease others' values 100%. Their behavior has no actual effect on anyone's value, not even their own. False dignity is an oxymoron. Dignity, defined as worthiness or value, is something that simply exists. It is unchangeable. To illustrate what I mean by this, here's a real-life example of what Cobb and Crownapple call a conflict between and among equity champions as a result of dignity violations during their presentation at an international conference in a southwestern state in the U.S. They say, during this workshop, participants shared experiences of being excluded, segregated, integrated, and/or included. They swapped stories in small groups before we brought the whole group together to focus on several illustrative stories from volunteers. A woman wearing a denim jacket and heavy glasses raised her hand to share. Appearing to be white and in her 30s, she wore her hair short, with the right side shaved close to her skin and the top dyed purple. "My name is Allison, and I'm from Minneapolis." Reflecting on what we'd presented, she stated, "This just happened to me yesterday at this conference. But first I want to preface that I recognize my reaction had to do with my own issues, projections, and assumptions. I was in a workshop on leadership, sitting at a round table with strangers. On each table was a large piece of chart paper. Our workshop leader invited us to draw symbols of our individual values on the paper. Someone at my table drew a large cross and said it represented her Christian values." Allison's voice quivered. "I'm from a liberal city in the north, and I've never traveled to the south. I'm also queer. Being here and having that happen, I suddenly didn't feel safe. I felt that I didn't belong." Abruptly, a woman near the front of the room swung toward Allison and declared, "You shouldn't feel that way." Then the woman glanced back at us, the presenters at the front of the room, and said, "I was leading that session she'd just described. That wasn't our intent." Allison looked shocked. Obviously, she hadn't been aware that the leader of her session was in the room. Flustered, she muttered, "I recognize that. It wasn't what you intended. I don't think you meant to make me feel marginalized. I truly don't think..." The woman, whom we'll call Linda, interrupted Allison. "You shouldn't make assumptions. We wanted everyone to connect by sharing their values. A cross isn't anything against you. It's just a symbol of that person's faith." Addressing us, Linda continued, "I mean, anyone can say that people make them feel unwelcome. Shoot, I could say that. I'm black at a conference full of white people. I could blame them for not making me feel accepted." "I'm not blaming you," asserted Allison. "Everyone's just too sensitive nowadays," said Linda. "We were just trying to present a workshop about leadership, not equity." Cobb and Cranable then go on to explain how dignity violations occurred in this whole scene. They say, "We offer this example not to blame Linda, but to illustrate how quickly and unintentionally we can fall victim to the temptations to violate dignity. Like much of what we've talked about in this book, this entire incident was about belonging. For Linda, this played out in her identity, a black woman who is a resident of the American South, at a conference full of white people who lives an existence where she probably never feels like she belongs. For Allison, this incident was about traveling from a region where she felt she belonged to one where there were assumed signals that she did not. Both women were seeking the same outcome. However, their inability to recognize their shared humanity led to this conflict. I've got to back up here for a moment and share what I got from this example. This whole scene that Cobb and Cranable present as an incident and violation of dignity was the complete opposite. What actually happened here is the lady who stood up to speak, Allison, saw a symbol that she, for whatever reason, saw as offensive. Maybe she has a past experience with someone or some place that is associated with the Christian faith, but that has nothing to do with the woman who drew the cross. Allison projected, as she even stated, her own ideas of what that cross means into the exercise, allowing herself to be offended by the symbol, assuming she is devalued by the existence of the other lady who drew the cross. Linda, the woman who denied the possibility of dignity violation, then implied that she doesn't feel like she is accepted at the conference simply because she doesn't share the same skin color as the majority of the people at the conference. Her statements implied that her dignity is being violated merely by the fact that the majority of the skin tones in the room were not the same as hers. These ladies assumed dignity violations. There was no real violation in this situation. The authors treat this example as though it was an event that occurred during the workshop, but I honestly see it as a non-event. Nothing really happened in the situation other than two ladies making a lot of assumptions. In fact, what I find remarkable is that there is no further mention of the third person in the story, the lady who drew the cross. The book doesn't even consider that woman's identity. She was simply expressing a symbol that has value to her. That's it. Everything else that happened following her drawing the cross was a complete non-event. If, as Cobb and Crownable say in their book, we are to accept people for who they are and treat them with dignity, then why was this woman's simple expression of what has meaning in her life treated as though she rocked the world of those around her and devalued their existence? Why was this even considered an incident? Nothing actually happened. The three women in this situation left that conference with the same value and worth with which they arrived at the conference. Dignity cannot be violated. People can perceive themselves as being devalued, but that doesn't change the fact that they are worthy. Belonging Through a Culture of Dignity goes on to say, when we humiliate another person, we undermine their humanity. In doing so, we make clear our belief in the lesser value and worth of the individual being humiliated and those like her. It's obvious there can be no culture of dignity as long as people are being humiliated. Through this dignity violation, we explicitly express our beliefs about a person's worthiness to have access to certain environments and, most importantly, their right to belong. Herein lies another theme throughout their book, and that is the assumption that belonging is something that can be forced. Cobb and Crownable are grievously mistaken. Saying belonging is a right or forcing belonging in an environment is like saying love is a right and forcing people to love one another. Belonging is something that occurs organically. It cannot be mandated or enforced by policy. When Cobb and Crownable say they, quote, explicitly express their beliefs about a person's worthiness to have access to certain environments and, most importantly, their right to belong, end quote, they are saying belonging can be compulsory. I deeply disagree. An environment where people are compelled to make me feel like I belong actually has the opposite effect. If teachers are compelled by some policy-driven belonging pledge, that student-teacher relationship is tainted and can feel less than genuine. I'd rather someone build a relationship with me because they want to, not because they're mandated. Fake affirmation and validation does nothing for one's self-worth and sense of belonging. Moving on, in Chapter 7, further discussing dignity violations, this belonging book says, be it racism, sexism, homophobia, anti-Semitism, or Islamophobia, the root cause is the lack of self-worth that is replaced with an artificially inflated sense of value, which carries assumptions of superiority relative to those who don't possess the attribute, like able-bodied, straight, white, male, U.S. citizen, standard English speaker, etc., that brings about false dignity. Again, these authors are blatantly picking on straight white males. I find it more and more difficult to even consider their perspective when they're presenting themselves as leaders in equity training, preaching on how we shouldn't discriminate or use stereotypes to group people, yet they do that very thing in their own book. I have two main goals with this podcast. One, to inform parents and other citizens about what is going on in public education by sharing the information and documentation I've found. And two, to encourage critical thinking by sharing my methods of analysis in hopes that listeners will be inspired to dive into their own local school districts to see what may be lying beneath the surface. This is why I pause in sharing information, to analyze the source. Something our current world seems to struggle with is assessing sources for information. People are so ready to believe everything they see or hear or read, they don't take the time to critically analyze and critically think about the message that's being conveyed. This is such an important step in communication. If we don't properly evaluate our sources, we are at the risk of believing lies and spreading rumors. We must dig deeper, question everything, and find the truth. We must be willing to think on our own and form our own ideas and opinions. We must be willing to give up ideas that we may have thought to be true but found to be false. We must seek understanding and communicate our thoughts respectfully, or no one will want to listen. This, my dear listeners, this is why education is so important. Education is meant to inform students of the facts and teach them how to read and write so they can not only gain more knowledge through reading, but then write so that others can understand them, so they can communicate their own ideas, their own knowledge and experiences. This is why I am doing what I am doing with my Facebook page, my podcast, and my book. We need our educational institutions to get back to educating our kids on the facts, the good, the bad, and the ugly facts. We need our kids to be proficient in reading and writing so they can not only understand the world around them, but also communicate with the world around them. Without these basic tenets of education, our nation is doomed. Let's hop out and dry off, as this concludes our swim for now. Join me next time as I try to wrap up this series on the book Belonging Through a Culture of Dignity. As always, I appreciate you coming along with me as we dive into the deep end of public education. If you're enjoying this series and you'd like to hear more, please be sure to like and subscribe. As I mentioned in my last episode, I wrote a book sharing the concerning things I found in my local school district and guiding parents through my journey of discovery. The book includes resources to help parents get started if they dare to dive into their local waters to see what's below the surface. If you'd like to get your own copy of my book, you can find it by searching Deep End of Public Education by Kristen Grubbs on Amazon.com. If you choose to get yourself a copy, I would sure appreciate an honest review of it on Amazon when you're done reading. I hope you've learned something new and feel encouraged to be brave in the deep waters near you. Thank you for listening, and God bless.